I'd invite you to open your Bibles to Luke chapter 8 and verse 22. The aftermath of the parables of Jesus. I'll say this over and over. There was a formal rejection of Jesus by Israel. They said, the leaders of Israel said, you're not the Messiah, you're Beelzebub. And so consequently, Jesus said, you committed an unpardonable sin, I can't help you now. And he said, the consequences of your sin are going to visit this generation and generations to come. And we know they were taken out of the land in AD 70, not just for 70 years, but for 2,000 years. And so Jesus then wants to tell his disciples that, and everyone else, that the whole program is going to change. And you'll see some of this. We went through the parables, the nine parables in Matthew 13 last time, and he talks about how the kingdom is changing. You'll see something tonight. A lot of times, not all the time, but when Jesus does a miracle, he tells the people he did it for, don't tell anybody. I don't want you telling anybody about this. Now, in the beginning, it was let everybody know. But what he's doing is he's controlling the scenario. Jesus is going, he'll say this often in the last part of his ministry. The Son of Man must go to Jerusalem. He must be arrested, you see, found guilty, crucified. And I have to go. But he's going to go in his time. And so while we pick it up tonight, Jesus is in northern Galilee. He's staying out of Galilee, staying away from Judea. He's staying away from Jerusalem right now because he knows his enemies, at the first opportunity they get, they're going to arrest him, but he's going to orchestrate that. So we pick it up in 22 of Luke 8. And it says, it came about on one of those days that he and his disciples got into a boat. It says, and he said to them, and this is very important, let's go over to the other side of the lake. Okay, that's crucial to understanding this. Because you're going to see what the problem is. If the Son of God says to you, let's go to the other side of the lake, where are you going? You see, I mean, if he says, let's go to the other side of the lake, you're going to the other side of the lake. If you believe he's the Son of God. You see, that would be surely the case. And so what happens is he said, let's go to the other side of the lake, and they launched out. As they were sailing along, he fell asleep. And he said, in a fierce gale of wind descended upon the lake, and they began to be swamped and to be in danger. Now, you have to understand how violent storms can be on the Sea of Galilee, what we would call a lake. Mount Hermon, just north of the Sea of Galilee, is 9,200 feet high. So it's a substantial mountain, higher than anything at east of the Mississippi. It's Rocky Mountain high. Okay, it's a high mountain. The Sea of Galilee is 690 feet below sea level. Now, it's hard for us to imagine. We think we live so close to sea level. We're at sea level. The Sea of Galilee is 690 feet lower than this. And I don't think Louisiana has anything in elevation 690 feet high. So that's how much lower the Sea of Galilee is. Well, when the air comes down off a mountain and hits the Sea of Galilee, it's known for incredible storms. The other factor is, though, this one is very incredible because the men who are running the boat are fishermen out of Cana. They're in the Sea of Galilee all the time. So it's not like this is the first storm they've ever seen, but this one is particularly dangerous because it's got a point behind it. And they came to him and they woke him and they said, Master, Master, we are perishing. Mark adds a little bit in his rendition, and it's important to know what he added. They wake him up and they say, Master or Lord, we are perishing. But they said, and Mark says, they said, don't you care? We are perishing. Like, don't you care? Now, I want you to remember, you're saying this to the Son of God. Don't you care? No, I don't care. I don't care about people at all. I've never cared about them. I became flesh, dwelt among men, lived a perfect life so that I could pay for the sins of the world, become sin on the cross, and experience the wrath of God for everybody. No, I don't care. I mean, it's just, but it tells you a little bit about the disciples. They're a lot like us in this sense. We allow the circumstances to affect how we see God. And we allow the circumstances to dictate to us how we see him and how he works. And you'll see this tonight as we move through some other stories, the same thing. Notice then, it says, and being aroused, he rebuked the wind, the surging waves, they stopped and became calm. And Luke says, he said, where's your faith? Mark says, he said, you men of little faith. What's wrong with you? I said we were going to the other side. You don't believe me? No, because the storm was so bad. That's why we couldn't believe you. He said, you have no faith. So remember, or hear little. The leaders of Israel have no faith. The disciples of Jesus have little faith. You see, this isn't like, oh, these guys are spiritual giants. They're not. They're not at all. So Jesus, it says, now watch. And they were afraid and amazed. And they said to one another, who then is this that commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him? You think one of them would have said, who do you think he is? You see, who do you think he is? They're like, who can do this? Now understand, they've been through a year and a half to a year and three quarters, and they've seen him do miracle after 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 miracle all the time. And now they get into, who could do this? Just tells you something about our nature as people. So they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, he said, which is opposite Galilee. The Gerasenes is a Gentile area off the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. They're going into Gentile land. Jesus is about as far away from Jerusalem as you can be now. And so they go into the Gerasenes. When they get there, it says, when he came out onto the land, he was met by a certain man from the city who was possessed with demons, who had not put on any clothing for a long time. You got to get a picture of this guy. Okay. He's naked. He's like that all the time. It says, he has not put on clothing for a long time and was not living in a house. He lives in the tombs. He lives where the graveyards are. He lives where the demented and the social outcasts live. That's where he's alive. And so consequently, you know, he's a very unusual character, to say the least. Now watch this. And seeing Jesus, he cried out and fell before him, and he said in a loud voice, what do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me. What did the disciples just do? Hey, man, who can do this stuff? Who can calm this? The demons say, notice this, the demons say to him, what do I have to do with Jesus, the Son of God, the Most High God? They know him specifically. Leaders of Israel don't know him. You're Beelzebub. The true demonic horde says, we know you. You're the Son of God. Why are you here? See, they're afraid. And I'll explain in a moment why they're so afraid. But they understand enough prophecy to understand that though their final doom will come at the second coming of Christ when he sets up his kingdom. We know, they know that. So they're wondering, what are you doing now? Why are you here now? What do you want to do to us? Why do you, I love this. Here's a whole bunch of demons telling to Jesus, why do you want to torment me? What are the demons doing to the man? They torment the guy day and night. That's their business card. We torment anyone, any place we can. And so they say, why have you tormented me? For he had been commanding the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had seized him many times. And he was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard. And yet he would burst his fetters and be driven by the demon into the desert. They tried everything to control the guy. They couldn't. He has a supernatural kind of strength. And he is just, he is a really active demoniac, to say the very least. Jesus said, what's your name? If you study demonology, you realize there's a whole angelology, the same thing. There's a whole hierarchy of angels and demons. They're very organized. And he said, what's your name? And he said, Legion, for many demons had entered him. My name's Legion. So he knows that this is an enormous group of demons in one man, one of the reasons he's so powerful. Now, I want you to see what's going on with the demons. And they were entreating him not to command them to depart into the abyss. That's a great word, the abyss. If you want to put terror in a demon, the idea they could end up in the abyss. Okay, now we've studied this before, but let me rehash this. There's a group of demons that are in the abyss. They've been in the abyss since Genesis 6. They've been in the abyss, and they will stay in the abyss until they get out in the second half of the tribulation. So they've been there a long, long time. This goes all the way back to Genesis 6 when there was, remember, the first prophecy of the Bible was that God made it, and he said to the serpent, he said, the seed of the woman will be your undoing. You will be destroyed by the seed of the woman. You will bruise him on the heel, but he will kill you. That's the prophecy. So if you're Satan or the demonic horde, what's the key here? Seed of the woman. Let's just destroy the seed of the woman. Whatever it takes. Completely different. That's a completely different thing. There is a distance between them that Luke 15 talks about. That's where humans are. This abyss is a place only where demons are. And you don't know what happened. In Genesis 6, it says that the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they produced Nephilim and a different kind of race. This is all before the flood. And we don't know exactly, like, well, what went on there? How did that happen? But we find out in the New Testament when you get to 1 Peter, 2 Peter, and Jude. And in all three of those, it says they left their normal estate. They left their natural estate. They decided to do something different. And they were bound and thrown into the abyss for it. It's not a matter that they were worse than other demons, because Satan's the leader and he's not bound at all. You know, that's pretty clear. So it's not a matter of degree. It's what they did. So they have this unbelievable, this fear of the abyss. Because then they are totally restrained, and they're saying to him, you're not going to put us in the abyss, are you? You're not going to put us in the abyss. It's an interesting conversation from that point of view. So he goes on and he says, now there was a herd of many swine feeding there on the mountain, and the demons entreated him to permit them to enter the swine. They're negotiating. We're just leaving them and going to the swine. And notice, he gave them permission. They were successful. They negotiated. He said, sure. Sure, you can do that. Now, you know why he said sure? Two birds, one stone. Okay? What do you mean, the swine? What are the people of the Gerizim's primary business? They're bootleggers. That's what they do. What do they bootleg? Pork. They raise swine. Now, you can't raise swine in Israel. It's an unclean animal. But just like with us, Jews are more than happy to buy it. On the black market, you see, they raise swine. And so consequently, Jesus said, yeah, you can go ahead into the swine. You can do that. He gets permission. They're not going into the abyss. They're pretty happy. It says, demons came out from the man, entered the swine, the herd rushed down a steep bank into the lake and was drowned. Two birds, one stone. That took care of that. It's kind of comical. Now, what's the response of people? Now remember, this is a demoniac that is so famous that men try to put him in chains. He's running around naked all the time. I mean, everybody knows about him in the Gerizim. And Jesus now takes the demons out of him. What's the response of the people? It says, and when the herdsmen saw what had happened, they ran away. They reported in the city and then out in the country. Everywhere in the Gerizim, that's the hot news. You know the demoniac? Yeah, he's not a demoniac anymore. Jesus came and took the demons out of him. Okay. The people went out to see what had happened, and when they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed in his right mind, they became frightened. Wow, that's an interesting, they're afraid. Now you could say, because they understood the power of the demoniac and they must understand the power of Jesus, but notice what happens as it goes on. He says, and those who had seen it reported to them how the man was demon-possessed and had been made well. And all the people of the country, the Gerizim and the surrounding district, asked Jesus to please depart from them. Would you please get out of here? Is that what you think the response would be? Why'd they say that? Business is business. This guy's bad for business. You see, this is bad. We don't need some guy killing all the pigs here. We don't need this. It's interesting. They asked him to leave, for they were gripped with great fear, so he got in the boat and returned. Now, the funny part is, the man from whom the demons had gone out was begging that he might accompany him, and he sent him away. This guy said, I'll do anything. Let me just follow you. Why wouldn't he? Just imagine the torment for how long this man had it, for how long it had been. He said, I just want to be with you. I just want to follow you anywhere you want to go. But notice what Jesus said. He said, return to your house and describe what great things God has done for you. And he went away proclaiming throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. This is really interesting. Who is the most effective witness for Jesus Christ in the Gerasenes? This man. That's because everyone in the Gerasenes knows this man. It's undeniable what happened to him. So what an effective witness he would be for Christ. You see, if he had gone with Jesus and gone down all through other places in Galilee and said, I used to be a demoniac, a lot of people say, well, he says that, but I don't know that. Everybody in the Gerasenes knows what he's done. Jesus said, you just stay. It's back to that bloom where you're planted thing. You'd be most effective if you just simply stay wherever you're planted. Now, what ends up happening is we now make another shift. It says, Jesus returned and the multitude welcomed him. For they had, he says, all been waiting for him. The crowds just love him right now. He's fed 5,000 on two occasions. They love this healing and feeding thing. They just think this is great. You can get a lot of good stuff from Jesus. You know, all you can do is follow him around. And so, behold, there came a man named Jairus. Now, he was an official of the synagogue. Now, this is interesting. Now, this guy represents what? The best of Judaism. See, he represents the best of Judaism. He's an official of the synagogue, likely one of their elders. And so Jairus comes to him, and it says, and he fell at Jesus' feet, and he began to entreat him to come to his house. For he had an only daughter, about 12 years old. She was dying. But it says, but as he went, the multitudes are pressing against them. So you have to kind of imagine the scene. This guy's coming to the Lord. There are a few thousand people around the Lord. Everyone's pressing. The disciples are trying, sort of like bodyguards, are trying to keep people off of the Lord. You know, they're not doing very well with it. But it's just a big mass of people being pushed around. Then it says this, and a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and could not be healed by anyone. Okay, it says, now notice she had a hemorrhage for 12 years. There's something we know. I don't know if this is the Canaanite woman of the Matthew section, but I can tell you this. This woman's definitely Gentile. She's not Jewish. If she's a Jew, she'd never put herself in that crowd because everybody that touched her is unclean. She's been unclean for 12 years. You see, her hemorrhaging would be just like being a leper for 12 years. She is unclean. She can't be in public, can't be with her family, can't be touched because she's unclean. And no one was able, Luke says, and her disease is incurable. And apparently they tried everything. The Jewish work, the Talmud, talks about women who hemorrhage and are unclean, ceremonially unclean. And they give about 30 cures to try with women who are unclean. And about three or four of them have a little bit of sense to them. And the other 25 are complete nonsense, superstitious nonsense. I mean, it's just amazing, some of the crazy stuff. But they knew this was an awareness thing because it made her unclean. This woman sees this as my chance to get near Jesus. And it says, and she came up behind him. She touched the fringe of his cloak, and immediately her hemorrhage stopped. He never spoke to her, nothing. She just touched his cloak, and now she doesn't hemorrhage anymore. And Jesus said, who's the one to touch me? Now, that's kind of funny, but here's what's really funny. What's the disciples? And they were all denying it. Not me, not me, not me, not me. I didn't touch you. Somebody, who touched him? I didn't touch him. James, you touch him? No. Andrew, you touch him? No, I didn't touch him. Peter says, Master, the multitudes are crowding in and pressing on you. How do we know who touched you? Jesus says, someone did touch me. I was aware that power had gone out of me. This is really interesting. So it says, and when the woman saw that she had not escaped notice, she came trembling, fell down before him, and declared in the presence of all the people the reason why she touched him and how she had been immediately healed. She felt the conviction. This is a Gentile woman. He said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Now, I want you to understand something here. The Jewish leaders don't want anything to do with him. They say he's a Beelzebub. His own disciples have very little faith. Here's a Gentile woman who never even got to speak to him, just tried to work her way through a crowd just to touch him. And he says, your faith has made you well. And this is interesting. Sometimes that's used by faith healers and stuff like that. Well, see, it proves you have to have faith to be made well, but it doesn't. Because as I've said to you before, sometimes Jesus heals people and they don't even know who he was. They don't have faith. They say, who did it? I don't know. I don't know what his name was. No faith there. But Jesus heals everybody, you know, with faith, without faith. But in this case, she came to him and she touches the fringe of his garment. And he says, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Now, while he was still speaking, someone came from the house of the synagogue official and said, your daughter has died. Do not trouble the rabbi or the teacher anymore. Now, just think how he felt. He's trying to steer Jesus to his house. Now he finds out his only daughter, who's 12 years old, is dead. Now, what do you think he's thinking about the whole conversation with the woman who was hemorrhaging, a Gentile? See, what a waste of time this was. My daughter's dying, and you're talking to this woman? Jesus is orchestrating this whole thing. Though. So, when Jesus heard this, he answered and he said, do not be afraid any longer, only believe, she'll be made well. He's trying to talk to a Jewish official now of the synagogue. Why don't you believe? You see, why don't you believe? And it says, and when he had come to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter, John, and James, and the girl's father and mother. Don't miss that. When they go to the room where the little girl is laying there, there's only five people in Jesus. Peter, James, and John, and her mom and dad. There's nobody else in the room, just them. He makes sure of that. Now, when they were all weeping and lamenting for her, he said, stop weeping. She's not died. She's just asleep. Now, this is really fascinating. You've heard me teach this in the past, but in the Old Testament and the New Testament, whenever a believer dies, it always says they don't die. They only fall asleep. Okay, they don't die. You fall asleep. Now, we know that falling asleep means your physical body dies, but your spirit lives on, absent from the body, present with the Lord, and all of that. But notice, Jesus describes this 12-year-old little girl the same way. She's asleep. She didn't die. Now, he didn't mean her body isn't that way. But notice, he says that, and now watch. There's only five people in the room, three disciples and the parents, and they began laughing at him. Wow. They laughed at him. Knowing she had died. Look, I don't know who you think you are, but I know this, dead's dead. She's dead. So they laughed at him. This wasn't like an unbelieving crowd laughing at him. This is Peter, James, John, and her parents. Like, what? You see, what? You see, here's the whole problem. The disciples have run into this before. What happens to us so often is you and I have a completely inadequate but almost always articulated view of Jesus that is completely wrong. As people, what we often do is say, Jesus is a lot of. We'll say that much. Jesus has a lot of wisdom. Jesus has a lot of power. He has a lot. Jesus can do a lot. That's not Jesus. Jesus is God. He doesn't have a lot of anything. He has all of everything. All of it. Not a lot. You see, not a lot. He's not only infinitely powerful, but he's also infinitely wise and infinitely good. If we would remember that, you know what you and I would have? Peace beyond all understanding, but we never remember this. You see, we never remember this. They're not remembering it here. They laughed. Hey, look, we know this, dead's dead. Not in his presence. He doesn't have a lot of, he's God. You see, that's the point of who he is. The storm, it's such a bad storm. Don't you care? We're going to perish. How could you ask that question of the Son of God? don't you care? You see, that's because we create this image. And so what we end up doing is, I want you to think about this. Whenever we pray, okay, for something to happen, he's going to answer every time one of three ways. Yes, no, wait. Okay, that's what he's going to do. He's going to answer yes, no, wait. That's going to be the answer. That answer should always give you tremendous peace, but it doesn't. You see, if Jesus says no to your prayer request, if he says no, what do we still know about Jesus? He's infinitely wise, infinitely good, and loves me more than anyone in the world. So the wisest, best being that ever lived told me no. Why isn't that good enough for me? You see, what's wrong with me? No, Lord. I want what I want here. And if you were wise and as good as I am, you'd give it to me. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that way, but we do. That's exactly the way we think. And then you hear, I don't know if he cares about me or not. I don't think he listens to me. What? You're talking about God. You see, that's who you're talking about. You're not talking about a guy with a lot of. You're talking about a guy that has it all. And we don't get it. We do this over and over and over again. And if you think about it, when Paul says, he said, be anxious for nothing, but in everything with prayer and supplication. Supplication means the emotional human part of my prayer. I can feel as deeply as I want. I have to let my request be made known to God. But he says, with thanksgiving, not when the request is answered, but when I make the prayer. Why should I thank God? Why should I thank God when I'm just starting the prayer? Because he's God. Don't you get it? He's God. If he says yes, he says so because he's God. If he says no, he says no because he's God. He's infinitely wise and infinitely good. You see, and somehow we end up disappointed. Like, he doesn't seem to care. He does. We don't go to this point, but his own disciples and the parents laughed because dead is dead. Too late now for God. You see, the girl's too dead for God. You see what I mean? He's God. There's no limit to what he can do. And it's somehow the reason we don't get the peace beyond all understanding is we just somehow just don't believe that. We struggle with this whole notion. And he's only good if he gives me what I want. Look, I've seen people die in this church that are died young, in the middle, and at the end. And if you think for some reason, and you've been praying your heart out for your 45 to 55-year-old spouse and they died and you're so disappointed they did, and somehow you think if God would only heal them and keep them alive, when they're 75 or 80, God can let them die and it won't bother me at all, you're wrong. I've been with people 80 years old that lose their spouse, and it's heartbreaking. Oh, it shouldn't be heartbreaking. When you're young, it's heartbreaking, but not when you're old. It's ridiculous. Listen, everyone in the world that you and I love and pray for, barring the Lord coming back, are all going to die. Every single one of them, including us. The key is he's on the other side of the curtain. You see, that's the whole point. He doesn't mind us praying. You see, we can pray out our heart. But the whole point is, it's Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Okay, what he did in the Garden of Gethsemane is something you and I can't understand. First of all, it said that he sweat droplets of blood. His body was going through unbelievable physiological problems because of what he was facing. Because remember, he is God incarnate, the Son of God, but he's also fully human. He also knows almost everything, see, everything. And he knows what's going to happen the next day. And you and I don't know what happened the next day. You have no idea. He's going to become sin, and he's going to experience the wrath of God for all the sin everyone in the whole world that ever lived committed. And he's going to pay for it all. What does that mean? We have no idea. We have no idea. I mean, we see a movie and, oh man, you know, like, You know, Mel Gibson makes a movie and they show that he was beaten a lot by the Romans, and they nailed him to his cross and they put that nail right in there. That's really terrible. That meant nothing to him. People physically die all the time. People are tortured to death all the time. That's not the anguish of the cross. The anguish of the cross is the wrath of God is going to be poured out on him. What does that mean? I have no idea. How could anyone have an idea? He did. That's why he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Father, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will be done, but yours." See, why was the nevertheless there? Because, "Father, I know you are infinitely wise and infinitely good, and I'll take the cross." You see, we can pray our humanity. We can pray for it. But the point of it is, when you believe in an infinitely wise and good God, when he says no, that should give you peace. But it's like, no, 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 I didn't get what I wanted. If I could get what I wanted, it'd be better. If it'd be better, God would do what's better. He said, "Look, all things work together for the good because I'm sovereign over all things." See, if we believe that, it's so beneficial to us, but we struggle. In this case, they laugh. Notice then, "He, however, took her by the hand and he called her." And I love this. It says, "Child, arise." He said, "Talitha kumi." It wasn't her name, I don't think. Talitha is lamb. Arise. It says child here. Talitha is not the normal word for child. He says, "Lamb, arise." And her spirit returned. She rose immediately, and he gave orders for something to be given to her to eat. Feed this child. The scene, I think, is if the three are like where you are, he just says, "Lamb, arise." And then he just turned and looked at him. "You were laughing. You see, don't you know who I am?" "No." See, they allow the circumstances to change that. He said her parents were amazed, and he instructed them to tell no one what had happened. How hard is that to do? You see, this is where Jesus changes his ministry. Don't you tell people. You're going to see in a minute, though, not everyone listens very well to this. It's kind of an interesting thing, the way this whole thing works out. But he says to them, tell no one that this has happened. Now, the next scene goes back. I told you the gospel writers don't write chronologically. Go back with me to Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9. Now, the way Matthew tells the same story, look at it in verse 23. He says, "When Jesus came into the official's house, he saw the flute players and the crowd in noisy disorder." The flute players in the crowd, this is kind of sad, but in Israel at the time, whenever someone died, you didn't take them anywhere. Everything was done at home, and then they were buried. And so you had to hire professional grievers. Okay. And I guess the reason would be behind it to show the significance of the person who died. So there were women who were professional wailers. And you'd hire them, and they'd come, and they'd know you from Adam, but they would just wail and wail and wail. And then they had musicians playing really sad music. And you have to pay them all, you know, but that was the idea of the funeral. The idea to make it look like lots and lots of people really cared. It seems so disingenuous, it seems kind of ridiculous, doesn't it, to just do something like that. But anyway, that's what had happened. And then it says, in that context, he said, "Depart, the girl has not died, but is asleep." They began laughing at him, they did. And it says, "And when the crowd had been put out, he entered and took by the hand the girl and arose. And this news went out into all the land." Now, what did he tell the parents? But everyone in the crowd said, "Well, I'm telling everybody I know about this." And that's not that unusual. So now please understand what's going on here. Jewish leaders, you're Beelzebub. That's all you are. And we don't want anything to do with you. His own disciples, little faith. The synagogue official, little faith. Some, but little. The Gentile woman, great faith. Okay, now we got the blind guys. And this is funny in and of its own right. It says, and as Jesus passed on from there, I just love this, two blind men followed him. How good are blind people following people? I mean, these are two blind men. He said, we got to follow this guy. So they're following him. I guess they just go with the crowd, but they're just following him. It says, two blind men followed him, and notice they're crying out, and what are they saying? Have mercy on us, son of David. That's his messianic title. You're the son of David. You're the Messiah. You're our Messiah. They're blind and they see it. The religious leaders don't see it at all. But the blind see it. The Gentiles see it. The demons see it. Everybody sees it except the religious leaders of Israel. Everybody sees it but them. He said, have mercy on us. And he says, after he had come into the house, the blind men came up to him, and Jesus said to them, do you believe that I'm able to do this? I love that. Yes, Lord. That's why we're here. We believe you. You see, when Jesus asked that question, it's a question for you and I. No matter what you're praying about, the question is, Jesus, do you believe I can do it? I think a lot of times we say, well, I don't know if you'll do it. I hope you do it. I don't know if I believe, but it's just a matter of your faith. He's not saying that's the linchpin. He's just saying, do you understand who I am? And blind men said, we do. You're the son of David. So notice, they said, yes. He touched their eyes and said, be it done to you according to your faith. And it says, and their eyes were open, and Jesus sternly warned them. Now watch this. See here, let no one know about this. Now, if you've been blind for your whole life, or say you were born blind, and a guy just touched your face and now you see, what would you do? Look what they did. But they went out and spread the news about him in all the land. Jesus said, don't tell anyone. They go, I'm telling everyone. I can't help myself. I'm going to tell everybody what he did. I wanted everyone to know what it is that he did. But notice, they're blind. Now, go with me to Matthew chapter 13 at the end of the parables. And Jesus now is back in Galilee, and he goes to Nazareth for a second time. He wants to go to Nazareth for a second time. Remember, he went in there the first time. He read from the scroll of Isaiah and then just sat down, didn't say a word, and they were waiting for him to say something, and he said, what I just read has been fulfilled in your presence. He took the prophecy from Isaiah that the Messiah is here, and he said, and here I am. They hated that, and they tried to stone him to death and drove him out of the city to a cliff area and tried to stone him, and then he just departed. But he goes back. So he's right back in Nazareth. And this time, it's very similar. It came about that when Jesus had finished these parables, he departed from there, and coming to his hometown, he began teaching them in their synagogue. He said, so they became astonished. And they said, where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? Now, you have to understand, Nazareth's a small town. Jesus is from a poor and uneducated family. Okay, his dad's a carpenter. That's about it. There's no one educated. There's no great rabbis teach. None of that occurs for people in Nazareth. Those are for people of more means or higher educated. And yet, even in Nazareth, they realize, I've never heard anyone teach like this. He teaches in a way I've never heard. And if 1/10 of what I hear about him, the things that he does, are true, nobody can do what he's done. You have to understand how revolutionary. We see it as Bible times, but remember, it's been at least 500 years since the Jews had seen any miracles. That'd be 500 years. And so consequently, Jesus comes and he's performing them like all the time, and it's a small country. It would be an overwhelming thought to start believing just how much he was talked about. I imagine he was talked about at every dinner. Have you seen what this guy's done? Have you heard what he's done? Because this isn't normal. It's not like, oh, we live in Bible times and there's always these miracles. They're not. The miracles occur in the Bible only in large numbers in very few places. And so that becomes his reputation. Now, what's interesting to me is it says, I love what they say next, is not this the carpenter's son. Like, where does this kid get these brains? Isn't he Yeshua bar Joseph? Isn't he Joseph's son? You met Joseph? You talked to Joseph? Where does this kid get this kind of wisdom? You see, that's their line. Like, we know Joseph. He's a nice fellow, but where did this kid get this? He says, his mother, he said, is not his mother called Mary? And what they mean by that, just nondescript. It's just Joseph and Mary's baby. What is going on here? We know these people. Then something that amazes me, he says, and his brothers, James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas. And his sisters, are they not all with us? I know the whole family. I know all of them. How can this guy be like that? See, it doesn't make any sense. By the way, the scriptures in the Greek there are as clear as possible. How Romanism ever is able to take this verse and tell you Mary was a perpetual virgin and Jesus was the only child? It's just nonsense. It's just sheer, utter, made-up nonsense. Oh, he just means he's talking about their cousins. He's not talking about their cousins. He's talking about his brothers and sisters. And the irony is, apparently, none of his brothers, for we know a little bit more about him, were believers until after the resurrection. And we know that is particularly true about James. And he becomes the lead elder of the Jerusalem church and writes the epistle of James. James is right. But none of his brothers are believers. And I've said this before, but I think you have to be sympathetic to them. Could you imagine the oldest brother and the oldest child in your family is Jesus? Just try to imagine what that would be like as a child. How many times do you think his parents would say to all these other kids, why can't you be a little bit more like Jesus? Well, he's God, and I'm not. No, I mean, what would you do? Just think of all the capers you get into as kids and the way family dynamics work. Did you guys do that? Yes, they did it. Who did it? Well, he did it, and he did it. She'd help too. And we're not. How would that go? Like, come on. I can't even imagine how different he had to be. He had to be as different as a child could possibly be. But they said in some ways he's similar. Look, we know the whole family. I know his mom and dad. I know his siblings. We know him. He's just one of us. How can he be who he's claiming to be? I love it. He said, and his sisters, are they not all with us? He said, where then did this man get all these things? Where do you get that? You got to understand, probably most of the people in Nazareth are probably relatively illiterate. Jesus is 12 years old, and he's spending his time with the Beth rabbis in the temple talking to them about the law. I mean, he's different. And notice, here's their response. They took offense of him. I don't like you. I don't like you. Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household. He said he did not do many miracles there because of their unbelief. That tells you something, though, about your faith. Very important applicational point. Familiarity breeds contempt when people know you. And one of the problems that we have when we're trying to witness to family members or very close friends is so often it's not very successful. And the reason is, I think our approach is a little bit off. A friend of mine who went to seminary with him was named Mike Green, and he taught at Dallas, and he taught at Moody and Wheaton, I believe, also. And Mike and I, we were both last name is G, so we were in classes together from the first year all the way through the fourth. We got to know each other, and he wrote a little book, and he was telling me about it on evangelism. And he said, my understanding of evangelism is it's a teeter-totter. And he said, it's always a balance. He said, there are the words of evangelism, and there are the works to evangelize. And he said, and obviously, when you don't know someone at all you can rely on are the words. But the greater knowledge you have of a person and they have of you should be your greater reliance on your works. In other words, you see how this works. So you get on an airplane, and I'm reading the Bible, and a guy said, what are you reading the Bible for? And I don't know if I'm mad at him. He doesn't know me. And when we just start talking, I'm going to do everything I can. in that short time to give as good a Christian apologetic as I can and talk about my faith in Christ. I don't know who he is, and he doesn't know who I am. But when it comes down to your family members, you see, what happens so often, especially some of the people in our church through its own history, so many of our people of our church are ex-Roman Catholics. And when they get saved by Christ, they're not only delighted that they're saved, but they're mad. They're angry. And they're angry at Catholicism. So they can't wait to talk to their parents or their brother and sister about how wrong they are and how horrible that. And they don't understand that it doesn't work very well. It just doesn't work very well. And the reason for it is that you're condemning them, you see, and they know you. It would be much better to pray for other people to talk to them while they get to see the evidence of what Christ is like in your life. And we've had a lot of people do this, but I can still remember a fellow named Steve Foster who went to our church, and I've used this before, but it was so clear. He was led to Christ by a fellow over in North Shore, and then that fellow set up lunch with Steve and I and him here at a restaurant right off West Esplanade at that time. And he was telling Steve he should need to come to our church, and so Steve did, and we talked, and we had a good relationship with Steve. And anyway, early on, Steve just said, you know, he said, the only thing I'm having trouble with is Sharon and I are fighting all the time. We're fighting, you know. And because he said she's just like nominal Catholic, but we're fighting about it. And, you know, he's found the Lord, so he wants to fight. And so I can still remember telling him, Steve, stop. Don't do that. Don't talk to her anymore about that. Don't do it. Why don't you show her what Christ is doing in your life, how he's changing you, and then see what happens. And I don't know, I'm guessing 6 months later or something here, it wasn't real long, so Sharon came to church with him, and they're a wonderful family and wonderful couple, and they live in the Woodlands in Texas right now, and their youngest son is the one I've mentioned before. When he graduated from Texas A&M on his own without a mission board, he moved to Jordan. He wanted to give his life to witnessing to Muslims. And so he goes to the Near East to witness to Muslims. And while he's over there, he ends up at a retreat or something they had, a conference, I guess, maybe. He finds a girl from North Carolina who had the same burden. So they were married on the island of Crete, I believe, in the Mediterranean. And I was just told at the 10 o'clock service this morning they have a baby now. And so, but what I'm saying is this, it was, you have to sometimes just be quiet. You know, and sometimes it's just got to be, you have to show what the evidence of the Lord. Listen, if Jesus Christ couldn't impress the people of Nazareth, they were not impressed. How are you going to impress people that close to you? I mean, that's what's so hard about this. And you certainly aren't going to do it by trying to argue with them. I'll just beat them down and they'll finally say, yep, you're right. You're the most right person I've ever met. And it's an honor to let you know how right you are and how wrong I am. That's just not the way things like that work. So Jesus had done that. Now, chapter 14, and then we'll first verses here. It says, now at that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the news about Jesus. And he said to his servants, now it's funny, this is John the Baptist. Now this is funny. Herod is the grandson of Herod the Great. All the Herods were insane. None of them as great. None of them as greatly insane as Herod the Great, but all were insane. Every one of them, power-driven. Herod the Tetrarch is the one who gets John the Baptist beheaded, and we'll just see this story in a minute. But once he started hearing of the incredible things that Jesus was doing, he said, "This is John the Baptist." Now he doesn't know Jesus from anything yet. He didn't know anything about Jesus, but he knows John. And he knows what John did to him and what ended up happening. And so he said, I think John's coming back. He's come back in this form of Jesus and is out to do this. He said, this is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead. And he said, and that is why miraculous powers are working in him. That's his thinking. There's a guy raised from the dead, but it's John doing it. No, it wasn't John, but that's how Herod's thinking. He says, for when Herod had John arrested, he bound him and he put him in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip. Now, he puts him because John had been saying it's not lawful for you to have her. Now, Herod Tetrarch is having a sexual relationship with Philip, his brother's wife. So it's an adulterous relationship. And John wanted to make sure he pointed that out to Herod. You can't do that. You just can't do that. And so, and it says, and although he wanted to put him to death, he feared the multitude because they regarded John as a prophet. See, Herod said, I kill you right now, questioning me like this. But I can't because you're so popular with the people, I'll end up with an uprising because I killed their prophet. So it says, when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before him and pleased him. Okay, and please understand, that's not like Dancing with the Stars. Okay, it wasn't ballroom dancing. It wasn't Broadway dancing. It was a different kind of dancing. Okay, that's, we're not talking about someone just doing a dance. Oh, that's a nice dance. This is a different kind of dance. We'll leave it there. And he said, thereupon he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. So, having been prompted by her mother, she said, give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist. Now watch this. And although he was grieved, the king commanded it to be given because of his oath and because of his dinner guests. Now notice Herod's thinking. Wait a minute, I'm a man of principle. And I took the oath, and I told you I'd give you anything you wanted, and if that's what you want, I've got to do it because I'm a man of principle, and all my dinner guests would think very highly of me. Now I'm going to murder a man and behead a man who's telling me I shouldn't be sleeping with my brother's wife. But I'm a man of principle. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So it says, although he was grieved, the king commanded it, and he said to be given because the oath and the dinner guest, and he sent, and he had John beheaded in prison. And his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. And his disciples came, took away the body, and buried it. And they went and they reported it to Jesus. Now, I want you to see this response of Jesus. I think it's fascinating. Now, when Jesus heard it, he withdrew from there in a boat to a lonely place by himself. And when the multitudes heard this, they followed him on foot from the cities. And when he went ashore, he saw great multitudes, and he felt compassion for them, and he healed their sick. I think this is important. Jesus is grieving because John's dead. He's beheaded. He's grieving to such an extent that he didn't want to be with the 12. He didn't want to be around anyone. He wanted to go and be by himself. That tells you the compassion that he feels. Like, does Jesus know where John is? Yes. You see, that's not the issue for Jesus. Jesus loved John. He grieved. In fact, he always grieves over death. Remember, Lazarus died, and Jesus grieved. See, if there's a great enemy, I'll use it that way, I'll use a metaphor. If there's a great enemy of God and everything good, it's death. God hates death. We weren't created to die. We were created to live on. Sin kills us. From Adam and Eve on, the day you eat of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil, that day you will surely die. In other words, sin kills us. And the consequence of sin is death. And that has tremendous grief to God. And that's why he sent a son. I mean, that's God's plan to deal with this whole idea of what is the consequence. What is the consequence of sin? Death. Separation, first of all, from my physical body, and secondly, separation from God. Jesus comes in and now makes it possible that that can be remedied through his sacrificial death on the cross. But it's always grieving to him. Knowing the end from the beginning and being sovereign doesn't give Jesus the edge that he doesn't feel enormously compassionate about the consequences of sin. Notice, it's not only did he grieve about John, but notice there in the next verse, when he went ashore, he saw the multitude and he felt compassion for them. Why? They're suffering. He feels tremendous compassion when people suffer. He feels tremendous compassion when you and I suffer. See, he doesn't take the unemotional part of it and saying, yeah, but I'm God, I know how I can work all things out, I know the end from the beginning, it's all going to work out, so it doesn't bother me much at all. It bothers him a lot. It's the price. You see, I've said this before, But, and it's appropriate in certain settings, but what is the price of real love? Grief. You want to know what love is? What's the price of love? Grief. Have someone you really love die, and you'll feel the grief. By the way, a lot of people die, and we're not happy they died, but you know what that's like. You're having lunch. Hey, did you hear so-and-so? He died. What? Yeah, so-and-so died. Oh, that's terrible. Would you pass a mustard? You see what I mean? I mean, that's it. And then we just go right about our life. But one of your children or your soulmate dies, you grieve that the rest of your life. It'll come in waves, and I always tell people, further and further apart, but it inevitably comes. And you could lose someone you love dearly, and 40 years later, Christmas time, you hear a certain song come on, and you feel the agony again. And that's because that's the price. And nobody loves like Jesus loves. For God so loved the world, he sent his only begotten Son. He loves, so he grieves our deaths because of the consequences of our sin. He put it into play, a plan in order to change that. But he's not distant from it at all. He's not above it. He's right there. John the Baptist dies and he wants to be alone in a boat because I'm grieving John on my own. Then he gets off the boat, people pressing in again, most with the wrong motives, but he feels compassion for them. He sees all the suffering. You see, that's his heart. And that's a very important part of the nature of God, that what we need to understand. You know, a lot of people have said to me over the years, you know, I don't get it. What, when Adam and Eve sinned, why didn't he just simply take them aside, say, okay, you're done, make two more, and let's get it right this time? Because if he did that, it would never reveal God's true nature. That would not reveal God's nature. There are things about God, you see, that God wanted to be revealed. Now, obviously, if he speaks and we have the universe, he's got a lot of power. We know that. On the macro, on the micro, he's powerful. He has knowledge. He knows the end from the beginning. He knows everything. But I think what we don't understand is the triune God is a relational being. Three persons in one being, and they relate. And God creates beings to relate to him. In other words, he creates beings to be loved and to love. He creates them. I believe his greatest creation was free will. How it operates, I have no idea. I don't think anyone else does either, with a backdrop of a sovereign God. But I will say God created these beings. In other words, God wanted to create beings who would love him. But in order to love God, you have to choose to love God. Could he have created beings that just come from the moment we're created, I love you, God, I love you, God, I love you, God? Could God do that? Is that love? Nope. Then you think of his forgiveness and his compassion. He couldn't have shown any of that without the fall of man. The fall of man allowed God to show all these different aspects of his nature. He feels in extremely deep levels. And these are the kind of pictures of it that give us a sense of what God's like. He's not impersonal. You see, he's not some impersonal force. It's not the way it works. He's a person, and he feels it in a really interesting way. Now, next time, and that'll be after the holidays, we're going to pick it up where he starts now the instruction of the 12. And he's going to give it his best shot. But it's interesting that it's a tough task. Let's pray. Father, thank you for these pictures of our Lord. Father, it just seems amazing to us that the kind of people, Gentiles separated from you, blind people who can't see, demons who possess a man, all recognize Jesus Christ. And yet, Father, the religious people who claim to be so close to you do not. What a lesson there is for us. Father, I thank you that you loved us enough to send your Son. I thank you that he loved us enough to go to the cross for us. I thank you that you loved us enough to raise him from the dead. Father, thank you for doing for us what we could never do for ourselves, have an eternal relationship with you. The eternal benefits are unimaginable, but the temporal benefits can fill our lives with joy and peace and hope. And that's what I pray for each and every one of us. In Jesus' name, amen.